We're hearing a school nurse's perspective on vaccination here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The vast majority of Wisconsin families are getting their kids vaccinated, but on the county-by-county level, there are vulnerabilities. And then these waivers, according to the State Health Department, religious and medical waiver numbers have stayed steady over the decades. It's the personal conviction waiver where they see the spike, and school nurses spend a lot of time on these waivers. Healthcare providers, how do you talk with families about vaccinating? What policies do you think could help prevent a contagious disease outbreak in your community? We're at 800-642-1234. Becky Wendell is a nurse in the Wittenberg-Burnhamwood School District in the central part of our state, and she represents the Wisconsin Association of School Nurses on the state's Council on Immunization Practices. Becky, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, when you look at vaccination rates, 2017 numbers from the CDC showing Wisconsin trailing 36 other states, how have you seen that affect you at the district level, at the school level?
Well, our percentage rate for immunization, meaning students who have received all the required immunizations for school, is hanging right around 95%. I do expect, though, that this year, once I have all the numbers calculated, that that percentage is going to drop slightly. I can't say for sure how much, but it will drop a little below 95%.
Where are the vaccinations stalling out? Is there an uptick in children not getting vaccinated for measles, mumps, rubella? You know, where are you seeing the vaccinations dropping off?
There has been an increase overall in students who receive no immunizations. And then I would say for children in the elementary ages, measles, the MMR vaccination and the varicella or chickenpox vaccination is the one that I see most frequently being missed or waived. And then more so at the middle school and high school level, it's Tdap that is being missed or waived.
And that's diphtheria?
Yes, tetanus.
Tetanus, diphtheria.
So, and pertussis.
And pertussis. Mm-hmm. So families can legally opt out of these vaccines by providing waivers. There are several different types of waivers. Can you tell us what they are and how they work?
Sure. So there's three waivers. There's the personal conviction waiver, which is for whatever reason, people just feel that vaccinating their child is not what they want to happen or not in their child's best interest. Then there is the religious waiver, and I feel like that's probably pretty self-explanatory. Based on your religious beliefs, you are choosing not to immunize your child. And then the third is the medical waiver. And the medical waiver requires that a healthcare provider is verifying that in this child's interest, it's better for them not to receive the vaccinations.
So personal conviction, that could basically be anything.
Sure, it could be. I didn't have time to make an appointment for my child to get immunized, so I'm signing a personal conviction waiver.
We're talking with Becky Wendell. She's a nurse at the Wittenberg-Burnhamwood School District in central Wisconsin. We're talking about vaccinations, how districts deal with waivers. Parents, have you decided against vaccinating your child? How did you arrive at that decision? Do you face barriers to getting your child vaccinated? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Becky, when you look at your overall job as a school nurse, how much of your time and effort are you devoting on making sure that the vaccinations are current or your waivers are current in your district?
Boy, I would say at this time of the year, leading up to the start of school and through the 40th day of school, so we have legally schools have timelines, so and that falls to me as a school nurse, timelines and deadlines that I have to meet. So I would say in these first couple months of school, I probably spend, I would say, close to 25% of my time working on immunizations, checking on waivers, contacting families, keeping administrators kind of abreast of what our situation is and what steps we may need to take. And so for the first couple of months, a lot of time.
Schools have to be nearly 100% compliant with getting either the students vaccinated or these waivers in. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. 99%.
So is that difficult for you to meet that 99% threshold?
Yes, it is. I have our school district right now hangs between 97% and 98%, and it's been pretty steadily at that range for the last few years. So over time, I've seen, you know, kind of a slow decline. I've been the school nurse here. This is my eighth year. So it is hard. You know, I do all of the legal requirements. I do the reaching out. I make personal phone calls, you know, but it is hard to kind of budge that number. So we've just kind of been hanging at 97 to 98% compliance.
What are consequences for the students who don't meet the state requirements?
For students who, if their parents or guardians don't make a decision either way, meaning the requirement is you either have to be immunized or sign a waiver. If you don't make a decision either way, you do risk the possibility of your child being excluded from school beginning on the 31st day of school.
Has that happened before?
Exclusion? We have not excluded any students. Our 31st day of school was yesterday. So as of Monday, a few days ago, there were four students who were still kind of hanging on, like, I wasn't really sure. We may have to exclude them, but waivers came in. And no exclusions were required. The exclusions are only for kindergarten through fifth grade. So we have a significant chunk of students who are not getting the required immunizations or having waivers, but they don't get excluded because they're beyond the fifth grade level.
Do you ever talk with parents who do sign a personal conviction waiver to make a case for vaccination?
It doesn't happen commonly. Most conviction waivers just come in, you know, I send a notice out by mail to start with. And most of the time, the waivers will just come back into me, you know, signed, mailed in or dropped off at the office, and an encounter, you know, conversation encounter doesn't happen. But occasionally, more so, I would say it happens just in passing, not so much related to the legal notices, but where parents will just ask me, you know, they see me in the hallway or before or after school and will ask some questions, you know, if they're hesitant or unsure about vaccination, and then we'll just have a conversation then.
And these waivers don't help with the ability to have herd immunity. I mean, you know, you're really trying to get your levels up, but a waiver can basically, you know, it clears the student, but it's not helping with your effort to raise immunization levels.
That is correct. So as I said before, our compliance rate tends to be 97 to 98% in that range for the past few years. Compliance just means either your child is immunized or you sign a waiver. With our waivers, our actual immunization rate has been about 95%. And as I said earlier, I think this year it's going to drop below 95%.
Talking with Becky Wendell, she brings us the school nurse perspective as we look at immunization in Wisconsin and how schools approach the issue with families seeking waivers. She represents the Wisconsin Association of School Nurses on the State Council on Immunization Practices. You can join in. How do you talk with families, healthcare workers, who are reluctant to get their child the scheduled vaccinations? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment. Maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at state vaccination numbers through the perspective of a school nurse who works with families. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The number of students in our state who are fully immunized declined slightly the last school year, and that decline is part of a long-term trend in Wisconsin of more parents opting to use personal conviction waivers. Our state is one of 15 that allow parents to get vaccination waivers based on personal convictions. Are you a school nurse or a public health professional? What do you tell families about vaccines? How do you help families with their questions and their ultimate decisions? We're at 800-642-1234. Still time for you, by the way. Becky Wendell is a nurse in the Wittenberg-Burnham Wood School District, and she stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Joshua is joining us from Watertown. Hi, Joshua.
Hey, Kate. How you doing this morning?
Good. What's on your mind about vaccinations here?
So my wife and I, we've been fighting this issue for so many years. We do not vaccinate our kids. Of course, we're not experts or anything like that. We just feel like the weight of what could happen if the vaccinations are given to our kids, it outweighs the risk. And we understand that there's a risk, but we understand that we do live in America too, and that if our kids do get sick, if we take care of it in a timely manner, that there are alternatives. There's a way for them to get better. So we fought with doctors, especially here in Wisconsin. We're from Houston, Texas, and we moved up here. And in Wisconsin, we found that the doctors are frowning upon us. So it's hard for us to find pediatricians for our kids because they don't want to see them because of the vaccination issue that they, you know, that we have.
Joshua, did you sign then a personal conviction waiver?
Sure. We do every single year. We do every single year. And like I said, we don't want anything to happen to our children based off of maybe a bad batch or a bad reaction. We are thinking when they get older, maybe going into high school, but obviously that's going to be up to them. That's going to be their choice.
Joshua, thanks for bringing your perspective here. Becky, what would you like to add?
I understand, at least to some point, the personal conviction waiver and what Joshua was saying, because I'm also a parent, you know, so I feel like I want to have say about my kids and about their health care and about the things that happen. So I don't disrespect his decision or parents like Joshua. I would just pause and say, though, that you have to, in some ways, see it from the pediatrician's point of view, in that they are, like myself, besides looking at individual children, we are supposed to be ensuring public health or doing our best to look at the health of a community and trying to reduce risk for the community in general. And so, you know, kind of frowning upon that or trying to dissuade you from that decision is them also trying to be a guardian of public health.
Let's bring in Kevin now in Platteville with thoughts on this. Kevin, hi.
Good morning, Kate. How are you? Very interesting subject this morning. Here's how this should go. You have the right in America to not have your children inoculated. It is at your peril, though. As with everything else, a problem in America, follow the money. What we need to do is pass federal regulations that say, if you do not have your child inoculated, then if your child does come down with one of these diseases, your insurance carrier will not cover you and you will pay cash.
Kevin, I want Becky to jump in here. And, you know, Kevin is also getting at something here in terms of legislation and certainly state capitol this year, it would eliminate Wisconsin's personal conviction waiver. There was bipartisan support for that. Where do you see insurance companies, as Kevin is saying, or politics entering this arena of public health?
Well, I guess I haven't really thought too much about the insurance part, so that is an interesting comment and thought. So I guess I'm not prepared really to speak to that. But politically, you can understand, I think, that at least from some sectors of the public, that there would be a lot of pressure to enact some kind of legislation eliminating or reducing parents' ability to go to a personal conviction waiver when you see the outbreaks of illness that have been occurring in other parts of the country.
And certainly, Kevin might allude to here, there is certainly an economic burden as well. If there is an outbreak in a district, that means kids can't go to school, and that ultimately means parents can't go to work.
Right, right. So I tend to kind of think through that lens a little bit more because I see it, you know, more on that level. When a child is sick, what does that mean for that child and their education? And then also, as you're mentioning, the economic impacts, parents having to stay home from work or find alternate childcare and the trips to the doctor and so on.
Let's bring in Stephanie now in Green Bay. Hi, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's on your mind? What question do you have? Can you hear us, Stephanie?
Oh, I can.
Okay, you were breaking up a little bit. Go ahead. Yeah.
I am kind of disappointed in the lines of questioning here. The question I called in with is, at what percentage is herd immunity effective? So if we dip below 98%, is the risk then that, you know, it's not effective?
Great question, Stephanie. Becky, explain for us herd immunity and what those numbers look like.
Sure. So to address this question, I think, real specifically, it depends on what illness you're talking about. For some illnesses, I'm just going to kind of go off the top of my head. The numbers aren't going to be exact. But for illnesses, say, like polio, I think for herd immunity to have the effectiveness that we look for, would be maybe between 80 to 85% of the population. But for things like measles, which are passed very easily and very quickly, for herd immunity to be effective, we're talking about mid-90s, so somewhere maybe between 92 and 95%. Remember, I am just speaking off the top of my head. But so that is maybe answer Stephanie's question directly. But how herd immunity works is that the more people you have vaccinated, the less quickly, when there is an illness outbreak, the less quickly that illness can be transmitted from person to person, the more people that have the vaccination.
Yeah.
So if you have a low immunization rate, the illness is going to pass much more quickly. And if you have a higher immunization rate, then the herd is protecting because there are many more people vaccinated, so you stop or slow down the progression of illness being passed on.
Let's bring in Polly now in Plymouth. Hi, Polly.
Hi. I am questioning the HPV virus. My friend had it done to her, had given it to her 13-year-old daughter, and that was a year ago. She has had so many terrible reactions. Her gallbladder's been out. I would like to know how the nurses feel about how the pharmaceutical industry is pushing these that are not as tested as the HPV.
Let's get Becky to respond here. And the HPV vaccination, giving to younger boys and girls here, what does that vaccination look like?
Well, I'm not sure that I'm prepared to speak a lot about that. That's not a requirement for school.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't spend a lot of time, kind of looking into how to talk with people about that vaccine. I mean, definitely it is one of the recommended vaccines. My children have been vaccinated for HPV. Anecdotally, I can't really speak to someone's reactions or the things that they've had without knowing more of the information. But if someone were to ask me, my reply would be based on the rates of HPV among young people and adolescents. And my own personal choice is my children are vaccinated for HPV.
What is your school's response or readiness plan if you do have a measles outbreak or if you start seeing another contagious illness spreading around your district? What's the plan?
Well, for measles, that is a reportable illness. And so for reportable illnesses to the Department of Public Health and to our local health department, we pretty much follow whatever they tell us we need to do. So in the case of measles, DHS and our local health department would direct us about what we would do. Again, with measles specifically, if there were a single case of measles in our school district, we would be required to exclude any students who do not have the MMR vaccination.
Becky,
not a choice.
Becky, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Becky Wendell is a school nurse in central Wisconsin, and she represents the Wisconsin Association of School Nurses on the state's Council on Immunization Practices. Coming up, Republicans in Congress stand by President Trump a little over 2 weeks into the House's impeachment inquiry. We'll look at developments on Capitol Hill with a UW-Madison political scientist and get your reaction to the investigation as you see it here. Do you think it's important for congressional Republicans to be in line with a president at this moment? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll talk about it after this news update here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're taking a look at how Republicans in Congress are reacting to the House's impeachment inquiry. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Most congressional Republicans right now refuse to break ranks with the president. So a couple questions to consider. What happens if something comes out that makes it no longer possible for the base to do that? And do Republicans, especially those who are in potentially vulnerable districts, do they want to go on the record opposing this impeachment investigation, not knowing where it will lead and what will be the end result? So what do you think about the inquiry as it stands 2 weeks in or so? We're at 800-642-1234. We're checking in with Eleanor Neff Powell. She is the Booth Fowler Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Madison, and her research focuses on Congress, money in politics, and political parties. Ellie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So we talked with you exactly 2 weeks ago, right after House leaders announced their impeachment inquiry. A lot has gone down since then. Can you pick a few recent developments that you've really honed in on?
Sure. And as you say, a lot has happened over the last few weeks. But I think some of the most important things, first, a lot of additional supporting information has come out about the Ukraine allegations, additional text messages, additional witnesses, additional whistleblowers. And so there's sort of strengthened evidence there. The president has also called for China to investigate the Bidens. And so that's a sort of opened up a whole new set of potential allegations.
Joe Biden, presidential Democratic nominee, or not nominee, but front runner, and Hunter Biden, the son.
Exactly. And then sort of more recently, the president abruptly, without consulting the Pentagon or the Department of Defense, announced American troops were withdrawing from Syria, abandoning our Kurdish allies who have been our big allies in the region against fighting ISIS, and essentially giving Turkey the green light to go in and potentially slaughter a lot of Kurds, a lot of civilians and military leaders, including that the Kurdish troops then have to abandon Syrian prisons that have been guarding these ISIS troops, these ISIS fighters, and they're now probably going to be released. And so opening up a lot of concerns about the future of ISIS and ISIS strength in the region.
Well, staying on Syria for a moment, we saw Senate Republicans challenging the president on this decision to pull American troops out of northern Syria. We saw Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell warning the president against a precipitous withdrawal, and even Senator Lindsey Graham calling it a big win for Iran and for the Assad regime. So in this instance, we're seeing Republicans really speaking out against the president, but on the impeachment inquiry, not so much.
We really are. There's a very interesting division here. Almost everyone who has anything to do with foreign policy, Democrats, Republicans, partisan, nonpartisans, is deeply concerned by this action and the abrupt nature of the president's decision. On the impeachment stuff, it's been very partisan and very divided. And so there's this big split. And part of it has to do with how intensely people feel about the issues. And part of it also has to do with the idea that, you know, Republican politicians aren't concerned that they're constituents are going to really disagree with them on these sort of foreign policy issues with regards to Syria. Voters don't feel strongly about that. They're not as likely to sort of vote on that when they're thinking about reelecting these members, whereas sort of support or opposition for the president is much more crucial to voters and could potentially cost Republicans at the ballot box.
Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, he's become one of the president's loudest defenders, backing the president about the 2016 election concerns. What are we hearing out of Senator Johnson?
So Senator Johnson had a sort of odd performance on Meet the Press this weekend. He's vocally been speaking out in support of the president. But last week, it sort of came out that Senator Johnson had actually heard about the allegations with regard to Ukraine earlier before they came out publicly. And when he was asked about this from the Wall Street Journal last week, he said he sort of winced at the possible connection. And there was a suggestion that there was a connection between investigation of the president's political opponents and military aid. But then this weekend, he sort of didn't want to talk about that on Meet the Press and pushed back very strongly that this investigation was illegitimate and that it was sort of all inappropriate investigation of the president and out to undermine him. But he didn't really want to circle back to his sort of earlier comments.
Yeah. There was a New York Times columnist saying the silence from Republicans right now is because on most issues, congressional Republicans don't actually disagree or disapprove of the president. And I'm quoting here, they might find him coarse and occasionally abhorrent, but that doesn't mean that they have a problem with his administration. Is President Trump's conservative politics right now serving him well in this moment?
It is. I mean, a lot of Republicans have been sort of may not like his choices, his words, other sorts of things, but they support his policies. And one of the things that they most strongly support have been his judicial nominations. The president, with the help of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, have done a lot to fill vacancies on the court and put in place a lot of very conservative jurists, which Republican senators and House members really want to see. And so they've sort of been keeping their head down on this other stuff in exchange for sort of big future policy changes that they hope to see.
We're talking with UW-Madison political scientist Ellen F. Powell about the Republican base being mostly lockstep with the president. Do you pay attention to the way your members of Congress react to President Trump right now? Does it affect in any way your party support or how you'll respond at the ballot box? What are you feeling right now about the politics you see on Capitol Hill and this impeachment inquiry? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Charlie now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. I just think that for the impeachment inquiry, it would have much more significance if it didn't appear to be such a kangaroo court and basically politically motivated. Why not vote on an impeachment inquiry in Congress and allow both sides to have subpoena power so that it can look like it's not politicized, but rather bipartisan as they go forward?
Charlie, thanks for that question. What about voting on this in the House?
So the caller brings up some great questions. The rules regarding impeachment, the sort of procedural rules, are somewhat odd. They're not actually spelled out in the Constitution. And the House doesn't really have – there are very few past cases, and the House gets to make their own rules. So whatever they want to do are sort of the rules regarding impeachment. Now, in past cases, the House would vote to sort of begin impeachment proceedings, but that was often an initial step so that subpoenas and so forth could go forward. But the House, under the Republicans, in order to investigate President Obama, gave committee chairmen and the majorities of congressional committees subpoena power. And so that was really the reason for that initial step. And it used to be that you'd have to sort of negotiate these subpoenas between the majority and the minority. But because the Republicans changed the rules to make it easier to investigate President Obama, the Democrats now don't need to go through that additional procedural step. So one could argue that as a matter of sort of public perception, it would be advisable for the Democrats to take that sort of initial procedural step. But in practice, because they set their own rules, they don't actually need to do that as a matter of impeachment. The House is sort of in an impeachment investigation when the House says it is.
But didn't we hear out of the White House Tuesday night that there will be no cooperation until there is an official vote here?
Well, the letter from the White House counsel took a number of positions, ones that probably don't have a lot of support in either past precedents and I think are going to face a tough time under judicial scrutiny. I think a lot of what the White House was attempting to do in that letter was to frame this investigation as illegitimate for their supporters. If you actually look into the sort of procedural rules and so forth that they were pointing to, they're going to have a really tough time convincing courts of their arguments.
Is it also possible that House Republicans want to publicly vote against the impeachment inquiry in order to delegitimize Democrats' efforts here?
I think they do, although I think, you know, it's a tough thing. There are some Republicans in the House who are from more moderate districts and so who could face difficult times asking questions about this. And generally, I would say we've sort of seen a disappearing act among a lot of both Republican politicians and a lot of sort of White House aides who don't want to take public statements. They don't want to answer questions about this. And so they've been laying really low. There have been relatively few allies of the president or really any Republicans who have tried to go out there and make statements. Most folks have just tried to avoid camera time, which is not typically what you say of politicians. Usually they're desperate to get in front of the news media.
Let's bring in Steve now in Sun Prairie. Good morning, Steve.
Morning. I think the guest answered my question, but I want to reiterate, you know, what I thought the answer was going to be, is that this is political theater. And the guest kind of just said it, that the Republicans changed some rules on subpoenas under Obama. And now the Democrats are using that to harm the Republicans by not allowing them to do their own subpoenas. And that's why it's not being brought up to a floor vote. That is a huge statement. That proves it's nothing but political theater. If the Democrats really were interested in the truth, they would allow the Republicans to do their own subpoenas.
What do you make of that?
Well, I guess I would frame things a little bit differently from the way the caller did. I think, you know, one of the things that sort of eroded over the last several decades has been procedural cooperation between the parties and the sort of breakdown. And, you know, in past impeachment investigations, a lot of the procedures were negotiated between essentially representatives of the president or the Republicans and the sort of Democratic leaders. And so they would sort of have to negotiate to sort of work these things out. And so sometimes you'd have hardline positions stated at the outset as sort of your initial negotiating positions, your tough line, and then you'd sort of have some compromise in between. We don't yet know how this is going to shake out. If the president says he's not going to compromise or have anything to do with any of this, it's tough to see the Democrats have a lot of incentive to move towards him to sort of find some middle ground.
Common ground.
Find some common ground. Maybe we'll see some negotiation happen as things play out, but it's tough to see that happening right now.
UW-Madison political science professor Ellie Neff Powell is here as we check in on the House's impeachment investigation. We explore the reaction to date by congressional Republicans as we see most Republicans, as Ellie says, silent in the face of this inquiry. What are your thoughts here? How have you reacted to this impeachment inquiry? Do you have questions now that we're 2 weeks in? Do you think it's important for congressional lawmakers to be in line with the president right now? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're getting political analysis here on the impeachment inquiry and how Republicans in Congress are reacting. Here with us on the morning show, I'm Kedar Chirkent. And it's been a little over 2 weeks now since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced an impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Republicans have largely stood by the president, but still some senators want to know more about the whistleblower complaint that started all this. Do you think it's important for lawmakers to be in line with the president right now, particularly when the president is a member of their own party? How have you been following the president's policy moves in Syria? When do you see the base breaking ranks with President Trump? Still time for you at 800-642-1234. UW-Madison political scientist Ellie Neff Powell stays with us. Ellie, at what point would it become politically advantageous for Republicans to support impeachment? What would that take?
So typically we think of this happening when the Republican Party brand gets tainted, right? And so, you know, we can think about the party's brand in a couple of dimensions. We can think about the brand as sort of how liberal or conservative the party is one element of the brand. But the other element of the brand is sort of like a valence element of the brand, sort of whether they have a reputation for good governance or corruption, that sort of spectrum, right? Are they sort of advocating in front, for the American people? And so I think, you know, typically we sort of start to think that you might have some distancing, some defection if the sort of net brand takes a hit and every sort of other party members want to distance themselves from their own party. And so I've done some research on this. And, you know, if you think if the party's sort of getting tainted with this sort of idea of corruption or the idea of sort of not advocating in front for the American people, both politicians and voters are going to start to walk away from the party or start to defect a little bit. And so there's a certain point at which, you know, if voters believe these allegations, are sort of concerned about that the president's acting in his own political self-interest and not to further Republican policy goals or to further sort of conservative policy ideas, then I think you might see both politicians and voters sort of start to step back and say, at the very least, we have other potential Republican leaders who could step in, right? And so that's sort of the disconnect that we might see.
You have to watch that spectrum. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Lee now, joining us from Lake Geneva. Hi, Lee.
Thank you for taking my call. My question and or comment is, it appears that the Republican Party, are more interested in power instead of taking the president's actions and words and deeds seriously as an impeachable offense. There seems to be a disconnect about the, being a Democratic party versus what the actual president is doing. So my question is, where are we going with that?
It's a good question, and we're sort of in unusual times in a bunch of different ways. You know, I think, you know, one way to frame what they're doing is they strongly believe in their policy goals, and they think the president currently is advancing their policy agenda, and they're willing to sort of sacrifice other things in favor of that policy agenda. Now, things like the president's abrupt change of policy in Syria, or when the president takes actions in Ukraine that might be contrary to the country's policy interests, that's where I think things start to get a little tricky, and you start to have some more foreign policy-minded Republicans start to step back and get concerned about whether this trade or the sacrifice they're making is really worth it.
Senator Mitt Romney of Utah is one of those outliers. He's the only Republican who's really strongly criticized the president, and Romney called the president's appeals to Ukraine and China wrong and appalling. What are we seeing out of Senator Mitt Romney?
Senator Romney, as you said, is one of the few concerned Republicans who's really speaking out and making efforts to go in front of the camera to say that. There are other Republicans who seem to be speaking behind the veil of anonymity to reporters and sort of expressing their concerns, but they're not willing to go on the record. Now, it's worth noting that Senator Romney has a little bit more electoral latitude here. Senator Romney represents Utah, and Utah Republicans, a sort of largely Mormon base, was very opposed to President Trump. I mean, they voted in favor of him, but I mean, Utah's a strongly conservative state, but they're not really a pro-Trump conservative state. There were a lot of sort of never Trumpers coming out of Utah. And so in some sense, Senator Romney has a little bit more latitude than a lot of his fellow Republicans in terms of his base. It won't be as concerned as long as Senator Romney is taking conservative positions, distancing himself from the president, expressing concerns, or the president actually is just in line with what his voters likely think.
15 current Republican senators served in the House or Senate during the Clinton impeachment. All but one voted either to impeach President Clinton or to convict him and remove him from office. That exception was Senator Susan Collins of Maine. Why are lawmakers who were so moved by President Clinton's behavior unmoved by President Trump here?
It's tough to say. And, you know, partially we don't really know how this is going to play out when they actually have to take a stand and vote on it. Right now, they just desperately don't want to take a position and desperately want to stay out of the limelight. It's tough to chalk these differences up to anything more than partisan differences. The potential allegations against President Trump are sort of much more severe relative to the allegations against President Clinton, which were serious and abuse of office and, you know, obstruction related. It's not that those weren't serious allegations, but these are, I think, much more clearly tied to the high crimes and misdemeanors envisioned by the founders when they were envisioning the sort of impeachment procedure. And so that disconnect is difficult to explain. Now, we'll see what actually happens if and when they're presented with that opportunity in the Senate.
We're catching up on the impeachment inquiry and this week's developments in Syria with Ellie Neff Powell. She's a political scientist at UW-Madison. Still time for your thoughts, 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the inquiry at this point? What do you think about it? What are your thoughts on President Trump's response to Turkish forces taking military action, as we see, against U.S. allies in Syria? Call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Ellie, take us back to the House where the investigation is at this point. An additional whistleblower has surfaced. What is the House trying to do at this moment here?
Right now, the House is just trying to get more information. And the really difficult thing here is the timeline. So typically, past impeachment investigations have lasted, you know, into year plus. And there's just not time for that. And they want to wrap this up, you know, as quickly as possible before you get into the throes of the presidential campaign, where everything's even more politicized than it currently is. And so the challenge here is for the Democrats to investigate thoroughly and comprehensively, but also quickly. And that's even harder because the administration isn't cooperating with subpoenas, and those things will likely end up in courts to be adjudicated. The Democrats or the House members are likely to sort of win those subpoena fights in the courts, but that's going to delay the process by months and months. And so this is the division that the House is facing. And it's even more complicated because the Senate will probably have to take up impeachment if the House votes on it, but there are no rules with regard to how long that investigation has to be. They could immediately put it up to a vote and not have any sort of hearings or investigation if they don't want to. And so to the extent that there's going to be a public investigation and an airing of these things for the American public to learn about and hear, it almost has to happen in the House because there's no guarantees of that procedural step in the Senate.
In the House, what are some of those important subpoenas coming up? Who are you really wanting to hear testimony out of? Who should we really be looking at for testimony?
Well, I think some of the most prominent players in this Ukraine thing are the ones who are going to be subpoenaed first, right? So obviously Rudy Giuliani, who's the president's personal lawyer, but in this case seemed to have been conducting foreign policy on the somehow tied to the State Department with regard to these allegations. He's subpoenaed. They're going to want to hear from him because that's not a typical thing that happens. And all of the various State Department officials who were involved with this are also going to be subpoenaed. And people are just going to know who knew what when. And then all the White House aides who may have played a role in then covering up and hiding the transcripts and these other records from these calls, those are all going to be top targets for subpoenas.
As we start to wrap up here, when does this cross the lines from being a partisan issue that lawmakers have to support the president on or take a line on or be silent on to really being a policy issue here where lawmakers can say what they think and what policies should say?
That's a great question. It's tough to give a strong or clear answer to. I think this is one area where I think as more facts come out, as we learn more, maybe folks are going to be able to step back from their partisan lenses and sort of try to understand and think more deeply about what's happening.
Well, Ellie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been talking with UW-Madison political scientist Ellie Neff Powell on the impeachment inquiry. Just ahead, Wisconsin authorities are working to create a statewide network that would reduce wait times for emergency calls and allow people to send videos or text messages to dispatchers. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.